I would like to ask you a very important question.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here, and I'm back. Live and lively here on Stand to Reason. Had 2 weeks out, and thank you for your patience letting me go, running some, best ofs or whatever we did. But last weekend in Minnesota, so cold, and the weekend before that, Easter week in Tasmania. That would be the island south of Australia. I thought it was Africa. This, of course, is the marketplace of ideas where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the open forum of talk radio. That means you can participate. The rules here at Stand to Reason, you call in and give me a piece of your mind, and I'll do the best to give you a piece of mine. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. All around the world, pretty much, except for if you're in Orange County, where I'm at. Broadcasting from Costa Mesa here, the number local is 754-4150. So you can dial up from wherever, according to the numbers I've given you, and talk to the enforcer, and she'll put you through, and we'll chat together about what's on your mind. Broad areas, ethics, values, and religion. Excuse me, and I want to start out this this broadcast with a reflection about the issue of proof. Of course, the new atheists are, selling books like crazy, and I've just written a piece in Solid Ground that'll go out the 1st of May, in which I begin a series of Solid Grounds in which I assess the broad arguments that they've offered. But the whole question of proving God from an atheist's perspective comes up, and I wanted to speak about that, especially since a friend of mine and a fellow broadcaster who's not a follower of Christ, he's a religious person, Dennis Prager, a religious Jew, but a friend to Christians and a good thinker. We've had great conversations together about things. This is an area where we actually disagree, but it was a comment that he made on one of his own broadcasts that have triggered these thoughts that I want to offer you on proof. Apparently, he had a debate with an atheist in some East Coast city, whatever. It went well. They enjoyed themselves, whatever, and he was talking about that. But apparently, during the debate or just afterwards, the atheist announced that he, the atheist, had actually won the debate because Dennis Prager didn't prove God's existence. And this was a notion that Dennis himself took exception with because, as he pointed out, his goal was not to win the debate, but rather it was to make clear where he and the atheist differ. And Dennis, as I do, values clarity more than agreement. And secondly, to elucidate the arguments for the existence of God. So Dennis was going to make a case for the existence of God, but he doesn't consider such a case a proof. In fact, he thinks that thinking about it in those terms is a big mistake. And during the broadcast where he's describing this debate, he made what for me is an amazing statement. And so I'm going to give it to you, the bulk of it here, just as he said it. He said, "I never in my life thought you could prove God's existence. You can prove the existence of that which is measurable, quantifiable, in some way either visible or audible." In other words, with the senses. But one of the senses has to be able to perceive it. It has to be measurable. God is infinite, transcends nature. So how could God be confined in natural modes of measuring? And then he adds, if God could be proven, it wouldn't be God. You can make a very powerful argument for God's existence, which apparently he attempted to do during the debate, and I'm sure he succeeded in that. But then he adds, just as you can make very powerful arguments against God's existence, and here's the concern, but the word proof doesn't apply to God, he said. The moment you enter the realm of proof, you've entered the realm of the finite, of that which is limited, of that which can be measured, and God transcends that. Close quote. Now, let me offer you an insight on this, because I think Dennis is really mistaken on this. He has offered the insight to his listeners because he thinks it's really important to understand that you can't prove God. It's a mistake to attempt to do so for the reasons that he gave. And there's an insight that pertains to discussions with atheists I want to offer you, and then I want to go back to Dennis's own comment. When atheists demand proof for God's existence, it's often a trick. Sometimes it's a reasonable request for evidence, but usually it's not. I mean, unless you know in advance what kind of evidence would count from the atheist, or for the atheists, I should say, whether it's scientific evidence or historical evidence or philosophical arguments or revelation. That would be a kind of proof, I imagine. And before you know, or unless you know, what kind of proof would be satisfying, absolute proof, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, proof based on preponderance of evidence. In other words, you need to know the kind of evidence that would appeal to them and the kind of proof that they're looking for. Unless you know those things, you're probably wasting your time by trying to prove anything by giving evidence to an atheist who raises this issue. And the reason is because it's too easy for an intellectually dishonest person to simply dismiss your efforts and say, well, that's not good enough for my proof. I have a different idea of what evidence is required. So when atheists say, what is your evidence for God or what are your proofs for God? You always have to ask them as a tactical issue, what kind of evidence or proof are you looking for? Because if you don't qualify your response to them in that way, they're just going to dismiss whatever you offer them. You're not going to make them happy. So you got to get it set up in advance. Now back to Dennis's challenge, because obviously Dennis isn't in that category. He does have a clear issue in mind of what proof is, but that's the question. To answer Dennis's challenge depends entirely upon what he means as a proof. Now, usually the word proof means either an argument that's attempting to deliver certainty. In other words, you have a series of premises that lead to a conclusion. This is deductive reasoning, by the way. And usually the word proof is used to describe this kind of argument that delivers like a certain, or some might say necessary, conclusion. That is a conclusion that you can count on. Now, sometimes a proof means an attempt that actually succeeds. So a proof could be the argument. And some people, when they say, well, I mean proof like a real proof, one of those arguments that actually succeeds in proving what you think it proves. I actually think this is too strong of a definition for proof, and usually philosophers mean by proof just a deductive argument. You know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Now that's an argument, and that's a proof, and it's a deductive syllogism. And I hope you can see that if the first two sentences are true, then the last sentence, the conclusion follows necessarily. It must be the case. That's what generally philosophers mean by proofs, something along that line. It doesn't have to succeed for it to be a proof in that sense. And by the way, I want you to notice something about deductive arguments. Deductive arguments are meant to produce certainty. If the argument is valid, that is, the steps that precede the conclusion logically lead to the conclusion, just like the one I gave you, if it's true that all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, then it follows that Socrates is mortal. So if the argument is valid, it follows along, and the premises are true, well, then the argument is what philosophers call a sound argument. And if sound, then it succeeds. It gives you a conclusion that you can count on. And this is why deductive proofs are so appealing, because these kind of proofs can't be false. Now, there are these kinds of proofs that are offered for God's existence. And I think some of these proofs, that is, arguments that follow a deductively valid sequence, can be very compelling. Here's one, and it's included in the Solid Ground coming up in May, dealing with the new atheists. First premise, every effect requires an adequate cause, and nothing can cause itself. Things happen. Things happen for reasons, and things don't cause themselves to happen. That's all I'm saying there. Very straightforward. Every effect requires an adequate cause. And the beginning of the universe is an effect. Therefore, it needs an adequate cause. And by the way, to be adequate, it would have to be outside of the universe, wouldn't it? Because the effect is the universe. So the cause would have to be outside of the universe. Simply put, and I've said this before in public, and I think it's kind of a clever way of putting it, it's memorable, and captures the point. A Big Bang effect needs a Big Banger, a cause. Pretty straightforward. Now, if you stipulate that the thing that is the cause of the universe is what you mean by God, well, then the conclusion follows from this argument that God therefore exists. Now, this is a very straightforward proof for the existence of God that is logically valid. And the only thing in question are whether every effect in fact, requires an adequate cause. I mean, you could take exception with that. But if that's true, and the beginning of the universe was an effect, didn't cause itself, well, then the argument goes through, and the proof, it seems to me, succeeds. And by the way, if the proof succeeds, then it means not just that it's probable that God exists, but it's certain that God exists, that it's necessary that he exists, and that's the nature of deductive proofs. So my first response is that I think Dennis is completely misunderstanding the nature of proof, at least the way people who deal with those kinds of things on an ongoing basis, philosophers, logicians, mean by the word proof itself. They mean a deductively valid argument that if sound, that is, if the premises are true, lead to a conclusion that can't be avoided. Now, can such a thing be offered regarding God? Of course it can be. So it seems to me we're within our rights to saying you can, at least in principle, prove God. Now, when it comes to these deductive arguments, of course, the real question is whether the premises themselves are true, and that's where all the activity is being spent. But it seems to me the only way you can say there can be no proofs for God's existence is if you deviate from the ordinary logicians, philosophers' definition of what a proof is. And this, I think, is where Dennis has made his mistake. This is just what he's done. And to kind of isolate his own argument here, to prove something, you must measure it by the senses, is what he's saying. God is not physical. He's not available to the senses. Therefore, you cannot prove God. Now, there is a logical argument. That argument itself is a proof. It's a deductive proof. And it seems to me that if the premises are true, given that it's valid, that is, the conclusion follows from the premises, well, then you've got a good argument here. But I don't think the premises are true, because to prove something does not mean that you have to measure it by the senses. I think this is an odd characterization of proof. For one, probably, I mean, this would be a surprise to Thomas Aquinas, wouldn't it? He's arguably the smartest guy that ever lived, apart from Jesus. Okay, and Jesus kind of had a leg up because he was God. That kind of helps. But apart from Jesus, Aquinas was really, really, really smart. In fact, right around 1200 AD, this guy puts forth proofs for the existence of God. Now, I understand that there are people who don't think that those proofs go through. These deductive syllogistic arguments actually accomplish what he thinks they accomplish. But they are called proofs because they are those things. They are attempts to prove, and they're using a certain deductive methodology. Now, even if the proofs don't go through, as far as I can tell, no one has ever accused him of impropriety. That since God was finite, that since God wasn't a finite material being, that therefore it's just a waste of time to offer proofs. Nobody said that, because in their understanding, there was no reason that you couldn't reason like that about God. Now, again, there is some debate about whether his proofs work, but they aren't faulted because God is not a material being and God is not finite. I actually think that Dennis's definition of proving something here is actually driven by a modernist impulse that the only things you can actually know, and here we're using know and prove kind of as synonyms, are those things that are known through science, which employs this empirical method that he's talking about. So science is what gives us truth about the world, and those are the only way you can have proofs of things. And that's why Dennis uses the language that he did about measuring or things you can see and hear, and the senses are involved. Now, here's the problem with that, and this is it's a bit surprising to me, because a lot of people may not realize this, and apparently Dennis didn't, but the irony is that science does not operate on a deductive method of proof. It operates on an inductive method of probability. So science by nature is never meant to prove anything. And if you talk to people in the philosophy of science, certainly, and people who are doing the work of science, they're going to tell you, well, you know what, we're always tentative about, or at least in principle, We're always tentative about our conclusions. Because of the nature of inductive reasoning, you reason from a body of evidence to a general rule that probably covers all the particulars. But you can never know for sure that it does cover all the particulars. That's a liability of inductive reasoning. So you go out and you want to find out what are crows like. Well, let's look at a bunch of them. There's a crow. Two legs, two wings, black. All right, so you draw from the group the general conclusion that crows have two legs and two wings and are black birds. But you realize, since you haven't seen every single crow in existence, that it may be that some crow might deviate from this, and so you make a generalization. It isn't a proof. And indeed, these kinds of proofs that are based on, and I'm putting scare quotes here around the word proof, that are based on scientific evidence have been disproved countless times. That is, scientists understood things to be one way at one point and another way at another point. They were wrong. Now, this isn't a liability of science. It is the nature of science. I'm not saying this so that you mistrust the deliverances of science. I'm saying this so that you understand properly how the empirical method works. Where Dennis is suggesting that the only kind of thing you can prove are physical things based on physical senses, I'm saying that these are the only kind of things you can't prove in any final sense, and science is never intended to do this. And this is why science, in principle at least, is never absolute. And I say in principle because obviously scientists deliver absolute judgments about things like Darwinian evolution. But in principle, to be fair for them, that's not the way it's supposed to work. It's never absolute. It's always somewhat tentative, theoretically. Now, here's the danger of Dennis's approach, and I'll close with this thought. From my perspective, it's that people associate the word proof with knowledge, and if you can prove it, then it can be known. If you cannot prove it, then it can't be known. Instead, it's simply an article of faith. And at this point, we mean leap of faith. And so it's what Dennis is saying, and I know I've heard him at other times make this point, that if you have scientific evidence, empirical evidence, then you've got knowledge. And if you've got knowledge, then there's no room for faith. But you can't have knowledge for spiritual things because there's no scientific evidence for those things. Probably he would say there's no proof. And so instead there is this, I don't know if he'd use the word leap, but certainly there is this faith. Faith as opposed to knowledge, opposite from knowledge, at opposite ends of the spectrum. I think this is a big mistake. If you know anything about how knowledge works and what the Bible teaches on this thing, these things aren't at opposite ends of the spectrum. They go together. Look in the Exodus account. 10 times during the Exodus account, God worked these miracles, it says there, so that the people would know that God was God. Know was the word. So that they should know. The book of Jeremiah has this like 78 times, the same characterization, so that they will know. The New Testament, the same thing. And it is this knowledge based on evidence that then people are enjoined to act upon, and that's what the Bible calls faith, an act of trust. It isn't a leap of faith. It's a step of intelligent trust. And, what matters to me is that you understand this. I mean, I think there's so much confusion about the concept of what proof actually is. Throw the word out. Don't even use it. What matters is whether or not you have arguments that are compelling and persuasive. And if you've given evidence for which the existence of God is the most reasonable inference, you've done your job. It's an inference to the best explanation. So my point is, there is no good reason to think you cannot have knowledge about God if the evidence is good. The Bible teaches this, both the Old and the New Testaments, and our common experience of knowing things teaches us this too. And this is why, by the way, Psalm 14 says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Now, how could God say this if the evidence was not overwhelming, such that anyone who does not believe is a fool? Now, there's no leap of faith necessary to believe in God, only an intelligent step of trust. Based on abundant evidence, and arguments that demonstrate this are available and they are compelling, and I think could be called proofs, especially ones that are deductive in form. And these kinds of arguments have changed many people's thinking for a long time because of their legitimacy. Okay, enough there. On to the calls in the next segment. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code. The local number is 754-4150. I look forward to talking to you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion right here on Stand to Reason. Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2nd, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, BC for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet, in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit, aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline, sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring a desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit str.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from str.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Careful, intelligent discussion about ethics, values, and religion. Greg Kokel, your host, giving you a piece of my mind today. With you every Sunday from 3 until 5. That would be Los Angeles time. By the way, on Wednesday next, I will be at Swarthmore College in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Swarthmore Students for Life have asked me to give a presentation on Only One Question. I'll be doing that at 7:30 p.m. So if you're in the environs and you want to come out and hear the talk, you're welcome to be involved. I think it's on campus. So go to our website at str.org, and if you find my face in the lower right-hand corner, punch it, and you'll find the schedule. Also, Friday this week, that would be the 11th, I'll be at North Coast Calvary Chapel here in Southern California, North San Diego County. Carlsbad, California, to be in particular, and I'll be talking at 7 p.m. about the new atheist, old arguments, new attitude, hope you can join us for that. We'll have a lecture on that and then some Q&A afterwards. So that's the 11th. That's this Friday. North Coast Calvary in Carlsbad. Hope you can make those events. Let's go to the phones now, and number one up, Tim in Austin, Texas. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Greg. Happy Sunday.
Thank you. You too.
I listened to your appearance on Reclaiming the Mind Ministries show, Converse with Scholars.
Right, yeah. It was kind of a webcast thing that people can kind of weigh in and talk. Yeah, it was kind of fun.
Yeah. And you were discussing the emerging church, mm-hmm. and you talked about contextualization and how we have to be careful that contextualization doesn't become compromise.
Yeah, right. Broadly,
and,
right.
Yeah, and you are well, that's a hot topic for me kind of right now, and mm-hmm. You said something that made me wonder.
All right.
I've been reading and commenting in a good series on a popular blog that's talking about concerns with that word, mm-hmm. and like how that word is used these days, and especially in the emerging church.
Mm-hmm.
And one concern being discussed is that contextualization is sometimes aimed at making the gospel palatable to non-believers.
Right.
And when you were talking on the show with Michael Patton, you actually used that wording.
Right.
You said something like, when we contextualize, we want to make the gospel palatable.
Right.
And I was hoping that you could expand on what you
said. Sure, I'd be glad to do that. I really would. because this is one of those notions that could be misunderstood, mm-hmm. and I'm using these terms not as an emergent type. I'm using it in more classical sense, but I'll explain what I mean by that. I was trained as a missionary and at the U.S. Center for World Missions in the early 80s. I've actually been in the mission field a handful of times for short-term things. I lived in Thailand for 7 months, for example, and I've done work in Eastern Europe before the Iron Curtain came down, and I worked in India and in some other short-term things. But the basic idea here is that whenever you go from one culture to another, you have to take into consideration the differences of not only language, the linguistic language, as it were, but also the cultural language and worldview sensibilities of the people, so that you don't end up communicating something that is – you don't end up miscommunicating something that is really important. So like if you have no sheep in your culture and Jesus is the Lamb of God and the only thing you have are pigs because they're the domestic animal – but to say that Jesus is the pig of God conveys a different understanding in that culture than it would be to say that he is the Lamb of God in, say, a Hebrew culture. Now you've got a problem. So how do you contextualize? How do you find a way to take this timeless truth and put it in a language that is sensible to those people? What I mean by that sensible is that it conveys the sense of the original notion accurately, and in so doing then you become more palatable to them. So you don't characterize it in a way that is technically accurate in one culture but becomes odious when stated that way in another culture.
Right.
And so in that sense there's a certain palatability. Now, but that's the sense in which I mean the concept of contextualization. Let me give you some examples of that, how I do that in the context of our culture, given that we're inside of our culture, but we really have a cross-cultural enterprise because we have different generations. We have a generational shift in thinking, so it makes it a missionary enterprise to reach out to the emerging culture because their ideas and their language and everything are different. So I know that, for example, among a lot of people, the word Christian is odious. All right. That is, when you say Christian, that conjures up a certain idea in their mind. And you've seen probably some of the polls. Well, Christian means anti-homosexual, bigoted, narrow-minded, hypocritical, all these other things. So now that isn't what my understanding of Christian is, but this is the kind of connotational link that people make with the word and these other qualities. So I don't say that I'm a Christian. I say that I'm a follower of Christ, for example. This takes some of the edge and some of the confusion off of it. And actually, the disciples who were followers of Christ were first called Christians in Antioch, so the concept of being a follower of Christ antedates the notion of Christian. Now, the word Christian is maybe a negative terminology in the minds of some people, so I don't use it. I use something else that actually conveys what I want to convey when this word no longer does the job. I also start my talks with non-Christian groups, typically in universities, by telling them that I have been deeply influenced by an ancient teacher named Jesus of Nazareth. So I don't even say Jesus Christ. I say Jesus of Nazareth. They're the same people. What am I doing? I'm adapting my language to reduce the negatives and increase the positives with the audience that I'm speaking at to. Now,
reduce
this
the false negatives.
Sorry?
To reduce the false negative.
That's correct. Now it can get to a point where what you are doing is you're kind of like weeding out. In order to be palatable, you end up – in some cases, you end up weeding out those notions that are unpleasant to people but are still central to the message of Jesus of Nazareth. Then you've crossed the line in my mind. And by the way, whether you're a modernists as well as postmodernists have done this. One of my beefs against the so-called super churches, the seeker-sensitive churches, which turn out to be usually seeker-centered churches, is that these are really consumer-oriented churches that do the same thing. They kind of weed out the offensive elements in many cases, which elements themselves are central to the message. such that you're not teaching speaking the message anymore. This can happen whether you're following a modernist impulse in some of these seekers churches or a postmodernist impulse in some of the emerging churches, particularly those who follow the emergent model of, say, a Brian McLaren, for example. Then I think what's happening is in order to be, you know, palatable, you are really removing the essence of the gospel, and Jesus becomes ice cream instead of the insulin that he is. That's the difference between, I think, adjusting the method and adjusting the message. And my suspicion is your concern is that some people have adjusted the message using the language of contextualization. And when that's the case, I'm with you on this one.
Amen.
I think that can – go ahead, your turn.
Well, let's see. I had one thought about the example that you gave with regard to not using the word Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to agree on this, but you said that you don't use the word Christian. And by that, I assume you mean that that's not how you initially voluntarily describe yourself to someone. It's not that you want to distance yourself from the word Christian or from which could become a way of or accidentally
right.
distancing
I don't,
yourself from the church for 2000
right, no,
years.
Yes. I guess I could, to be honest, I am distancing myself from the word Christian. I am not distancing myself. I do not mean to be distancing myself from the church.
Right.
Now, I think emergent types in particular, and I'm distinguishing here between emerging, which is the broader group, and emergent, which is this more narrow group. And when I say emergent, kind of think very roughly Brian McLaren, because he's kind of the leader of that point of view. Pardon me?
I think you just said when you say emerging, you mean Brian McLaren. You meant to say emergent.
Yeah, Brian McLaren is part of the emergent village, capital E,
right.
capital V. You know, and
right.
Doug Padgett from Minneapolis. I was just there last week, not at Padgett Church, but I mean that town, the Solomon's Porch, and Tony Jones. These are three principals in that movement. So those particular kind of people, you know, when they use some of these, my tendency is to think those people who use that language from that group use this language. I think to take the edge kind of off of some of these central issues of Christianity.
Right. And the stumbling block.
yeah, right. And so they're trying to distance themselves from the church that they don't want to be associated with because they think this is a modernist church and that is, you know, that's kind of bad to the roots. And so they're trying to really distance them. That's not what I'm doing.
Right.
I'm distancing myself with the word. I stand Christian, and I stand with the church, that is that assembly of people who are called Christians characteristically, with all its warts and whatever, you know. I don't think it's as bad as a lot of people are characterizing it to be.
Right.
And I think part of the reason that Christians are characterized badly by emerging types, emerging culture types, non-Christians, postmodern types, is because those Christians are not holding politically correct views. So, you know, if you think homosexuality is immoral, then you're anti-gay, you know, which is a different thing in my view, you know, and you don't care for the poor and you're hypocritical and you're not like Jesus and all these other things. And this just isn't a fair, I think, characterization of what Christianity actually is.
Amen.
Yeah. So are we on the same page there?
Yeah, I just have one more comment with I guess a wrap up question.
Okay.
So it sounds like when you talk about in contextualization, we try to make the gospel more palatable. Like you would be careful to say that that doesn't mean that our goal is to make the gospel palatable. Our goal is to communicate the gospel clearly.
Yes.
Which to some extent will be offensive to some people, but
yes.
we don't want any stumbling block to come from miscommunication.
Absolutely.
Or from our attitude or
right,
our
right. Or
the way that you present.
Exactly, Tim. We don't want to fulfill negative stereotypes or characterizations.
Yeah.
We want to avoid those things like the plague. And this is where I think the emerging church writ broad is a help to us because they can see our flaws very clearly, and people like Brian McLaren are very quick to point them out. Now, I know it's hard for us when we hear the way that's done and sometimes what appears to be the attitude it's done in, but I think still we can learn from that. And if you go to Stand to Reason's website and you look up our Ambassador's Creed, I think what you're going to see in these 10 virtues, intellectual and moral virtues of a good ambassador, I think you're going to see our attempt to try to adjust or adapt to those concerns that are pointed out by the emerging church. And by the way, we came up with these 10 virtues before there was any, you know, visible emerging church crowd to criticize the conventional church. So, I mean, we've been, in other words, these are things that we've held for a long time, and I think they will go, those virtues, those 10 things, the Ambassador's Creed will go a long way to addressing those kinds of problems that you see that these people are pointing out.
Yeah. So if the emerging church is may sometimes be immature and like throw the baby out with the bathwater in some of the ways
sometimes
they criticize traditional church.
Yeah.
We want to be mature and humble in the way that we hear, even when someone might be going off the deep end. If they have any valid points, we want to hear that.
Yes, I think so. That's my view. Right.
Yeah.
In principle, I mean, it doesn't mean that everything that those guys say is wrong. And I mean, it's a broad movement, and even within the emergent village, you have differences between the three men that I identified. So I want to be fair to them, but they really represent kind of a particular way of going about the emerging project compared to some other people like Dan Kimball, who are going in a different direction. So I think you're right. I think you characterized it well.
Yeah.
All right.
So just one more quick question. So would you summarize contextualization as and the concerns there as cultural awareness to allow us to translate and illustrate the gospel message so as to communicate it like accurately and accurately.
Yeah, clearly, persuasively, and in a meaningful fashion. Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. Sure. Yeah. Good
Great.
Job, Tim.
All right.
I'm glad to talk to you, Tim. Thanks for.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad I had a chance to clarify that point, too. So let's go to break. And no, we are or we aren't. Let's go to break. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Let's go to break. And I'll be back with more of your calls here at Stand to Reason. Thanks. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
I'm a rightful man, I'm Henry. Henry the eighth I am. Second verse, same as the first. I'm Henry the eighth I am. Henry the eighth I am, I am.
Is that Herman?
I got married to the
Herman and the Hermits. Hermit is like a, you know, a guy who's living on an island somewhere, right? Like if he goes on a cruise and then ends up on an island. Yeah, and we're going on a cruise. I could see the relevance here. Yeah, our cruise, August 2nd through 9th, Stand to Reason's Alaska Cruise with Josh McDowell and J.P. Moreland and yours truly. We're going to have a great time. I just want you to know we've been advertising this for a long time. This is the last month you can sign up. I mean, in other words, after May 1st, we can't guarantee a berth. So if you've been thinking about this for a while, now is the time to strike the iron. It's hot, all right? Go to our website at str.org and I think it's right there on the main page. Isn't homepage? There's a click through and follow the prompts and all of the information of our conference, our cruise conference, is there. And it's August 2nd through 9th, and we're visiting a number of ports, and we're leaving out of Vancouver, and it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it, and also to sharing with J.P. Moreland and Josh McDowell, who's going to be our main guest speaker for the cruise, and of course with us for the entire time. So we hope you can make it. If you've been thinking about it, again, now's the time to go and register and let us know you're on board so we don't lose your room that we'll be taking away from us, our kind of our package of rooms starting May 1st. So give us a call. Want to respond to a caller, and I guess he dropped off, but he asked a question. We don't want to do that? What are we doing? Okay, I can do this one? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know how to take orders. I'm just the president. Dave in Atlanta called, and he asked a simple question. He says, given the statement prayer changes things, his question is, does it? Well, that strikes me as an easy one to answer, but it's an answer to the question that is not easy, that is not difficult also to gainsay, that is to simply deny. The easy answer is, of course it changes things. There are millions upon millions upon millions, including myself, of Christians, including myself, who will attest to that. Now, some people will say, oh yeah, well maybe it was just a coincidence. Well, you can always say that about anything, it seems to me. But Christians have more than just a prayer that is prayed and then something happens that looks like the answer to it. First of all, sometimes the answer to the prayer is not the kind of thing that could be a coincidence, because the request is the kind of thing that requires a miraculous intervention, and that then what happens looks like a miraculous intervention. Before the prayer, there was a tumor. After the prayer, there wasn't. Now, you can talk coincidence all day long, but it isn't going to answer that one. Now, I had an answer to prayer last night. It was at 1:30 in the morning. My wife and I were up with our little Eva Ray, and that baby was in a bad mood. It actually, she doesn't get in a bad mood, really. She cries when something hurts her, usually, like she gets a bubble or she has gas or who knows what, but last night something like that was happening. Now, I've mentioned before in very candid moments that I think my prayer life could be stronger and my faith index could be higher and all of those kinds of things. And so, and I'm working on that. Some people seem to have this gift and it just comes naturally. Other people, it's a lot harder. But last night I laid hands on this little girl and I prayed for her. And I will tell you, I did this in front of my wife as the spiritual leader of our home, and I prayed for her relief. It was like a 30-second prayer, and I prayed in the name of Jesus. And I took I went out on a limb. It's not the way I usually do things. Usually I pray in secret for healings, right? You know, so you don't look silly if it doesn't happen. I mean, it's just human nature, right? So, oh, ye of little faith, I know some of you are thinking, well, that's exactly right. I mean, I acknowledge that. It's my liability. But in any event, this time I stepped out. Of course, when I stopped praying, the baby was wailing just as much as when I started. It's 1:30 at night. I said, honey, I got to get up tomorrow, prepare for a show, go to the show. I'm going to bed. She's going to stay up with the baby as long as it takes because she's a good mom. I crawled into bed. I went right from the living room into the bedroom, crawled into bed, pulled the covers over my head, and I said, what the heck is up, God? Here I am stepping out spiritual leader of my family, taking a chance visibly before my wife to pray for our child, and I'm invoking your ability, asking you for this as I ought by the authority of your son Jesus, and what do I get? Nothing. I'm frustrated. I said, that was my prayer. And yes, I was under the covers. My head was covered, principally because it was cold in the room. But in any event, I prayed that prayer. I had not finished saying that for 10 seconds. And all of a sudden, I felt someone getting in bed with me, and it was my wife. And I rolled over, and I said, where's the baby? And she says, asleep in her crib. So there you have it. That was an answer to prayer. Now, some of you might say, well, that was a coincidence. Why would you say that? Only if you have a prior commitment to the idea that prayers don't get answered. That was a request, and the request seemed to be answered immediately afterwards. Now, there's one other thing to the equation here that's important. It isn't like this is done in a vacuum. For followers of Christ, theists in general, we have good reasons to believe there is such a God that can do such things. So on separate evidence, we believe that God exists and that he's involved in his world, and Jesus himself, a man of deep spiritual insight by just about anybody's assessment, believed that prayer changes things, and he told us to pray by his authority in his name, and God would respond. And so when you have reasons to believe God exists, when you have a worldview in which prayer like that makes sense, which worldview is well justified, and then you pray and you appear to get an answer, the most reasonable thing to conclude is that God did it. And it seems only unmitigated and unwarranted skepticism would conclude otherwise. Why not just give the benefit of the doubt to God, for goodness sake? Which I did. I said, thank you. Which is a little bit humble pie after the private prayer I prayed, after the public prayer I prayed. I have every reason to believe that prayer changes things. Some people's prayers change things more than other people's prayers. I wouldn't be the one that I would encourage you to come to for powerful prayer, but there are people like that, and some of them pray for a standard reason, and I'm glad for that. You keep doing it. And in this case, God answered my prayer. So there you go. Let's go to Gene, and let's see, is that Orange Brook, Florida? Let me get the number here. Gene, Orange Brook or Orange Park?
Orange Park.
Is
correct.
That like in the center somewhere, like Orlando?
No, it's actually up near the Jacksonville area, the northeastern part of the state.
All right. That's where like all those Navy guys are at, right?
You're right.
Oh, yeah,
two okay. Navy bases here.
Okay.
Absolutely
well,
correct.
Glad you called, Gene. What's on
your
mind?
I was just going to say, my wife and I really enjoy your ministry a lot, Greg.
Good.
We haven't known about you that long, but we're just so thrilled to have found you. And
mm-hmm.
Anyway, what's on my mind today, my pastor preached a sermon on doubt,
mm-hmm.
and used as his text the ninth chapter of the Gospel of Mark, which you will recall the story about the father who brought his demon-possessed son to Jesus' disciples,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't able to cast the demon
mm-hmm.
out, and then Jesus comes into the picture and starts, and of course kind of rebukes the disciples for their
right.
lack of faith. Interviews the father and asks him about the son, and his dad said, yes, it's
mm-hmm.
he's young, and the spirit has cast him in the fire and in the water, tried to kill him many times. And
mm-hmm.
and the father, you know, asked Jesus, if there's anything you can do for us to mm-hmm. help us, you know.
Yeah, right. And Jesus said, if anything, you're like, if I can
yeah.
help, are you kidding me? Yeah, one of those responses, yeah.
Exactly.
I recall this, right.
Exactly. And so, of course, then Jesus, you know, heals the boy. And
mm-hmm.
My pastor took a pretty hard line on a hard position on doubt, and basically tied in, just made the statement, you know, all doubt is sin,
mm-hmm.
and tied in the passage from Romans 14 at the very end, 23, you know, whatsoever does not proceed from faith is sin. And of course, I don't want to take anything out of context that
mm-hmm.
you taught us on that chapter about Christian liberty. And then I think of the passage in James chapter 1 where, you know, James talks about the man who doubts is like the wave of the sea
mm-hmm.
that's tossed, and, you know, he shouldn't expect
mm-hmm.
to receive anything from the Lord.
Right.
And the role of doubt in over the years of my Christian walk has been, to me, I think it's kind of indispensable for
mm-hmm.
growth and maturity as a
mm-hmm.
disciple. You know, doubt is dangerous. We need to resolve them. But when we do resolve them, we grow and we move on. And that's kind of how I feel about it.
Sure.
So I guess my question is all doubt sin? And can we make a blanket statement like that?
Yeah, well, if I said I doubt it, I'd be in trouble, wouldn't I? Like, So let me try to make some sense out of this. And a lot depends. Each of these verses, I think, helps provide a piece of the puzzle. But I don't come to the conclusion that your pastor comes to, because of the qualification, I think, that is inherent in each of the verses that you offer.
Absolutely.
Doubt could mean different things, all right? Doubt could mean uncertainty. Now, in the case of the Romans passage, this is a circumstance where mature Christians are exercising, if I recall properly, this is a case where mature Christians are exercising their liberty appropriately, but there are some who are doubtful there and uncertain about whether or not this is a legitimate Christian liberty or not, and therefore their consciences are misinformed, I think, according to Paul's teaching. Like, they think eating meat sacrificed to idols is wrong, but it's not really wrong, but they think it is. They are to act based on their convictions so they don't injure their conscience, I think is the point there. And if they act based on uncertainty or doubt, then that's sinful. But it's sinful not because they have a doubt, I think. It's sinful because they are acting in a way that, based on their doubt, they are doing something that they are doubtful is morally correct, and therefore they're injuring their conscience, which I think is Paul's, in a sense, micro point in that passage. Don't cause a person to injure his own conscience. I mean, not micro point, it's a main point there, but there's a number of points going on there. And so I think that the concept of doubt in that sense isn't just doubt writ large, but it's people who are doubting that they're doing the right thing, but go ahead and do it anyway. And instead, they should wait until they're sure. Because anything that is of doubt in that restricted sense is sinful, because it violates one's conscience. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
See, I think that dispatches that passage with regards to the broader point your mm-hmm. your pastor is making. In Mark 9, which is the first passage you cited, notice that who does Jesus fault for their doubt? You stated it when you were quoting.
Yeah, he actually faults the disciples,
exactly.
Not the man.
He faults the disciples, not the man. The man says, look, I do believe, kind of, help
right.
my unbelief. So there you have a mixture of belief and doubt. And that mixture of belief and doubt was not chastised by Christ. Instead, Jesus responded to what belief he did show by reaching out even tentatively to Christ. If you can. What do you mean, if I can? Like, all things. Then he says all things are possible to him who believes. And there's some question about what all that entails. But the point is that here this guy had – he was tentative. He went to the disciples. Disciples couldn't do the job, and the disciples were the ones who were faulted. Now, the disciples were in a different position than the man. The disciples had walked with Jesus for a long time, right? They saw the kind of things that Jesus could do and the power that was available. In fact, let me just see here. I think in Luke's characterization of this, this is recorded after Luke records the 70 going out and casting demons out,
uh-huh.
you know, that mini missions trip that he had.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes you can't always count on the consecutive order kind of thing, or the temporal order, because the disciples don't always put it that way. But it may have been in this case that first they go out and then they cast out demons, and now they can't cast out this demon. So this seems to be a failing on the part of the disciples, because they had the resources to actually not have doubt about this thing, but to have confidence. And so that's why Jesus faulted the disciples. Now keep in mind, if the teaching is that all doubt is sin, I actually think that's a damaging teaching, although I think your pastor's probably a good man, but I kind of chafe at that. It just troubles me terribly, because this is one of the objections that the emerging church types have against the church, that there's no freedom to kind of question from the inside. Any event, I don't think that that point is made by the Romans passage, and I don't think that point is made by the Mark 9 passage. Now, James is just identifying James's statement is simply an indicative. That he's saying this is the way it is. If you're a person besieged by doubts, you're going to be tossed to and fro. Well, is that true? Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. So there is merit to having more confidence, but he doesn't identify doubt as sin per se. All right? Now, I think if you think of doubt as uncertainty, then you have an entirely different circumstance. If you're not certain about it, there are often reasons why, and the uncertainty can drive you to a to get the answers for the things that you are doubting in that sense, and then strengthen the convictions that you actually have. And this is what you've identified, I think, probably has happened in your own life, Gene. It's happened in my life as well, and I think this is doubt of a good kind. I don't think people need to be afraid of doubt. I think it's a natural human condition. I think they need to know that there are answers to their doubts and that God is capable in the midst of our doubts. And that's a better sermon lesson, I think, than what you heard today. Thanks for the call. Hour number two just ahead. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
Are you talking to me?
All right, friends, this is our second hour together. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. And since I've been gone for the last couple of weeks, I will, I think I'm going to go right back to the calls here in just a moment, very quickly. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say before I go to the calls. Some callers on the line, we'll get to them if you want to give us a call. And we've got basically an hour left, and I'd love to chat with you about whatever's on your mind, the area of ethics, values, and religion. Let's go to Carl in La Mesa, Southern California here. San Diego County, right?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Carl.
Hello. Greg, we fault the Mormons for the Book of Mormon not having any archaeological evidence to mm-hmm. back it up. And I wonder, though, aren't we to some extent in the same boat with the Book of Exodus? You know, as far as I know, been like supposedly millions of people died out there, and yet there's no bones, no artifacts ever been found that I know mm-hmm. of. What would you say on that?
Well, my first response is it's kind of apples and oranges, okay? The Book of Mormon is the entire testament of the Mormons regarding Jesus being visiting these various civilizations here in the Americas. Nothing, as I understand it, nothing in the Book of Mormon has been verified in terms of, archaeological evidence. Massive civilizations that were claimed to have existed, there is no physical, there are no artifacts of that at all. When you take the Hebrew scriptures, which is taken at large, is an historical account of the nation of Israel, there are massive amounts of archaeological evidence that touch different stages of the history of Israel. There are places in the history of Israel where we do not have archaeological evidence, not yet, and we may never get that. But see, it's a very different thing to say that not everything in the Old Testament has corroborating archaeological evidence, and on the one hand, but nothing. Well, I should have started differently there. It's one thing to say not anything in the Book of Mormon has any corroborating historical evidence, though they claim that massive civilizations, advanced civilizations, actually existed. By contrast, claiming that not everything in the Hebrew scriptures has been verified. Many things have been. And by the way, notice that you said no bones have been found?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, we're talking about 3,500 years ago. Do you think that you expect to find bones or something like that from a battle or from a conflict that was allegedly happened 3,500 years ago?
Don't we have bones that old, really?
We may have a couple, but not many. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing is not required in order for someone to... I don't think we have, any bones from the Peloponnesian Wars, right? Do we have any bones from the Peloponnesian Wars?
I'm not sure.
I don't think so. But that's not. But it's irrelevant. The reason is because we have people who wrote about those things with some detail, and it's the historical accounts themselves. Do we just lose Carl? Looks like we did. Okay, I didn't do that, Carl. My hands are folded. I haven't touched any button. So I will finish the point, though, because you're in La Mesa, so you can hear the show live. We do have, with regards to the Peloponnesian Wars, we have people who wrote about them to give us details, and we have the same kinds of writing giving us details of those historical events surrounding the Exodus. Now, I just want to be fair about this. Is it a little bit of a liability to us that we don't have this information? Yeah, it makes it a little bit more difficult. And this is one era of biblical history in which we have virtually no artifact or archaeological support. But there are, I mean, some would contest that and say there are some evidences. But, I'd be willing to bite the bullet and say we don't have a lot. But that in itself is not a good enough reason not to doubt the accounts are true, because we have the accounts themselves. The irony here is that when you go to biblical archaeology, it's almost as if the Bible doesn't count unless you have corroborating archaeological artifact evidence. But that isn't the way archaeology and history is done. Sometimes you have written accounts. Sometimes you have artifacts. Sometimes you have both. They are different kinds of evidence. And I think it's the kind of a meanest sort of bias, not that, and I don't mean this coming from Carl, but for those minimalist archaeologists that say, you know, the Bible doesn't count unless you have corroborating evidence. The Bible is evidence. The Bible is evidence. These are ancient documents written by people of that time. Now, it doesn't mean you have to believe every word of them, but there's no reason to just dismiss them as many people do. They don't dismiss other writings like that. So I wish there was more evidence about the Exodus, but what you can't do is conclude these events didn't happen simply because we don't have corroborating evidence. There are a massive number of historical events that we have no corroborating evidence for, except for written accounts. Yet we still have reason to trust those written accounts, and I think this falls in that category. The reason people don't want to believe the Exodus is because it has 10 plagues, has supernatural miracles and parting seas and that kind of stuff. That's the real problem. All right, thanks for the call, Carl. Let's go to – did I dump him? No, okay, we got covered here. Let's go to Seattle, and that would be Matthew. Hello, Matt.
Hi. Greg, I just was – I have a question on Romans 15, verse 28.
All righty. I'll go there here quickly. It's towards the end. I think Paul's talking about his plans for the future there. All right, got it. Yeah. Romans 15, 28.
Yeah. So verse 28, he says, when therefore I have completed this and have delivered to them what has been collected, I will leave for Spain by way of you.
Yeah, he's talking, just so people bring up people up to speed, he's talking about, in the book of Romans, he's writing to the Romans about his plans to go to Rome. And there's a number of different reasons he has for going to Rome. One of them is apparently to collect some money. And this seems to be what he's referring to here. And he says, once I go to you and I have ministry and fellowship and bear fruit and collect this money, then I'm going to keep going and my plans are to go on to Spain. Which apparently he never does, although we're not sure about that. So go ahead.
That was basically my question was, and it seems like here he's saying that he will leave for Spain.
Right.
Then, from what I understand, he got arrested or something in Jerusalem and then
right.
or somewhere and never made it to Spain. So I was just kind of confused.
Yeah, well, he did.
That first sentence.
You're right. In the book of Acts, we see details about his arrest in Jerusalem and all of that surrounding that and how he eventually has to appeal to Caesar. And so in order to, because he's a Roman citizen, so he appeals to Caesar. They put him on a boat. They take him to Rome. They take him to Italy. and then ultimately to Rome, where he is in prison at the Book of Acts, and he is in prison kind of in a house imprisonment. This is probably early 60s. He ends up dying in what probably was a second imprisonment in maybe 64 or 65, which leaves like 2 or 3 years in the middle there, where he might have gone to Spain. But we don't know for sure. But I'm not going to bank on that. I think probably he didn't. But I think the question here is this an error? And I guess it depends on what you mean by an error. What would make it an error? He said, let's just say he never made it to Spain. So he says, when I finish this and put my seal on this fruit of yours, this collection apparently, I'll go on by way of you to Spain. I'm planning to go to Spain. So what would be the error? If he never did this, what would be the error?
And I guess the error in my mind would just be that he's saying that he will leave for, or that he will be going to Spain.
Right.
And that he never went to Spain.
Well, how would that be an error, though? I don't understand. Why would that be an error? I could say I'm going to get coffee, and then something gets in the way, and I don't get coffee. That wouldn't be an error. That would just simply mean that my things changed. Are you understanding Paul to be somewhat supposedly omniscient about his future, and so every statement he makes about his future has got to happen just the way he says he's planned it to be?
No, but what I'm thinking though is that, and I'm confused. He's, you know, inspired by the Holy Spirit,
mm-hmm.
so I just don't understand how while he's inspired by the Holy Spirit.
Okay. Oh, no, that's a fair question. Okay, let me try to explain it. Our understanding of inspiration is that the Holy Spirit is working such a way that the people who are writing write everything that God wants them to write.
Okay.
Sometimes what they're recording are their own speculations about the future. You even have, in a sense, unregenerate people saying lies in the text. No,
yeah.
God has not said. Here you got Satan in chapter 3 of Genesis. Has God said? No, he really wants you. You know, he tells. Did Satan tells a lie? Well, the lie is accurately recorded there. So there is nothing inconsistent about there being a lie recorded in the Scripture and the Scripture being inspired. God wanted that to be communicated, and God saw that that point was communicated, but he is not standing behind the lie, as it were, affirming that it was true when it was not. And by the same token, we have in the Book of Romans, Paul communicating these things, and then sometimes he talks like he's doing, here's my plans for the future. I'm planning on going to Spain after I travel through you, and through Rome. And it may turn out that he never did go that. Is this a compromise in our doctrine of inspiration? No, not at all, because our doctrine of inspiration doesn't mean that every word, every statement is true. It's all the things that is declared to be true by a credible source, by an appropriate source, actually are true. What the Scripture seems to affirm is the case, but all it affirms here is that Paul is saying these are his plans. He is not giving a prophecy. He is not speaking with omniscience about the future, so this wouldn't be an error in my understanding of it.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
And also... And I think also in verse 24, it makes it, or like if you follow your rules, you know, reading, always taking the context into account.
Yes, never read a Bible verse, right.
Yeah, and he says that I hope to see you in passing.
There you go.
As I go to Spain. So
exactly.
You take it in context, yeah.
And he says, I have for many years a longing to come to you whenever I go to Spain. And maybe that would be if ever I go to Spain, too. It turned out he went to Rome and he didn't go to Spain, as it turned out. But it seems, I think the point you're making is that he's expressing his expectations. He's not giving a prophecy.
Okay.
All right?
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks a lot for your call, Matt. Let's see. Let me take another call here before. 1-800-227-5278. Let's go to Chi-Town. Hey, we don't get calls from Chicago very often. Maureen, thanks for the call.
Oh, great. My question would be, how would you help someone to understand that two opposite things cannot be true at the same time?
Yeah,
I know that sounds so simple, but people don't seem to get that.
No, I know this. That would be hard if the people really believe this. Now, the point is, to be more precise, it's not just two opposite things, but it's two contradictory things.
Yeah,
and that's a little different.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Because opposites suggest there could be a middle, something middle. So you got white and black are opposites, but then you have gray. But when you have contradictions, it's one or the other, either A or non-A.
Right, that's what I meant.
Yes, okay. So there's actually a famous line that comes from some medieval thinker, I think, or maybe before that. His response to those who reject the law of non-contradiction, which is A could a thing cannot be A and not A at the same time. That is, contradictions, one leg of the contradiction is always going to be false. And so he says, here's what he said. He said, people who reject the law of non-contradiction ought to be beaten and whipped until they acknowledge that there is a difference between being beaten and whipped and not being beaten and whipped.
I like that.
Yeah, it's great. I wish I would have invented it, but somebody long before me thought it up. But it's clever, and it really makes the point in a good way. And what I've often done for people who have denied this, and sometimes you've got postmodern types that are going to deny the legitimacy of reason or the laws of reason. That's just a modernist thing, they say. I said, no, look, it's a human thing. That's why all human beings have operated in this way. You can't even have a language without the law of non-contradiction, because you would not be able to distinguish between words if the law of non-contradiction didn't apply. And so language itself functions because these laws of logic are kind of working at the same time. Nobody invented these things. That Aristotle just kind of observed them and gave names to them, but he didn't invent them. So if you want to, the way that I've used is you kind of take their point of view for the sake of argument and you live it out, and they say, well, the law of non-contradiction doesn't apply. Contradictory things can be true at the same time. They say, oh, then you mean contradictory things can't be true at the same time. They said, no, I mean contradictory things can be true. I know, but this is a contradiction. If that's true, then the contradiction can be true at the same time. So you say contradictory things can't be true at the same time. In other words, you apply – they are when they say contradictory things can be true at the same time, they are subtly employing the law of non-contradiction. And so you want to – they shouldn't be allowed to do that, because they're arguing that you don't – that it doesn't always apply. So you just apply their denial of the law of non-contradiction to their denial of the law of non-contradiction. So they would have to say that it is true that contradictory things can be true, but it's also false that contradictory things can be true. And they both occur at the same time without a conflict. But they don't want to do that. They want to affirm their view. Does that make sense, what I'm offering?
Yeah, it does.
It's always hard to kind of role play this their view back on them, because it's so absurd. It sounds absurd to try to apply it to their circumstance. It is absurd, for goodness.
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
That's the problem. It's nutty. And this is why this little quote from this ancient person is so clever, because it really gets to the point easily.
Okay.
What is the particular issue of non-contradiction or whatever that you've dealt with?
I can't really think of anything offhand right now, but just – even in just general conversations about, either there is a God or there's not a God.
Yeah, what's the third option? I mean,
right, exactly. You know, or God is personal or he's impersonal.
Yeah.
You know, and people still, I guess, just in matters of religion, will still say, well, all religions can be true. And I try to bring them to the point where I explain, well, not all religions teach the same thing.
Right, right.
You know, contradictory.
That's a great, it's a great argument. Look, and I've pointed out to people, and I don't know if you get solid ground through the mail and the things that we send out free to those who want to receive them in the mail, but a while back I wrote a short piece, that talked about the reasons that people deny what ought to be obvious. And sometimes they're rational reasons, sometimes they're prejudicial reasons, sometimes they're emotional reasons, and sometimes it's just plain old bullheadedness. And this sounds like what you run into a lot of times when you have people who deny the law of non-contradiction. You can't get around that thing, you know. It's just right there, but they end up talking foolish. Incidentally, when you say that God maybe can't be personal and not personal, I think that's a fair statement. But keep in mind, some people might or maybe you use the word impersonal. People might misunderstand the word impersonal, and they mean like, you know, somebody's not a very personable person, you know, like he's just not, doesn't talk a lot, doesn't carry on with people. They might be confusing that notion. So this is why I say either God is a personal being or he's not a personal being, you know. He's an impersonal force.
Right, like a force. Like
yeah. So just so it makes it clear to them. But, you know, I think you're onto it. And there is no magic bullet here. There is no argument that is going to wrestle everybody into submission, because people can always irrationally gainsay a reasonable argument. And they do it all the time. They deny it. In other words, they just say, well, it ain't so. And now what?
Right. Yeah, and it happens not just in matters of religion, but in pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of just kills the conversation right mm-hmm. there, because you just can't seem to move past that point. Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe you could just ask the question Columbo style here, and I'm going to have to go to break then. Is there a difference between being tortured and not being tortured?
Hmm.
They say, yeah, well, on your view, there is no difference. That's what happens when you abandon the law of non-contradiction. All right, thanks, okay. Maureen from Chicago. And I will, it looks like we got another call from Chicago coming up. We'll get to that after the break. Two in a row. Okay, break coming up. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2nd, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, B.C. for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring a desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit str.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from str.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Time for dialogue, for education, for questions, for debate about vital issues of life. And, of course, you can participate by calling me, Greg Kokel, at 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code. That's where I'm at right now, Costa Mesa, Orange County, Southern Cal, 754-4150. Let's go back to Chi-Town, Chicago. And is that Luis?
Luis.
Hello, Luis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Greg.
Hey, where in Chicago are you from?
I'm actually...
Hey, who's
that's
that?
My wife. That's Sarah, actually. She called about a month and a half ago regarding in vitro.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. Sure. A lot of people responded with emails about that call, by the way.
Oh, well, you helped us a lot. We wanted to give you thanks, first of all, because thanks to all your information that you gave us
and
letting us, you know, ask the question that we had. It definitely gave us a moral anchor to actually go through it. It didn't work out.
Oh.
It didn't work out, but we praise God
today,
and definitely your ministry definitely helped.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. That's really great. But where in Chicago do you live? Did I ask you that last time?
No, actually, I'm a little bit up north. is actually close to Waukegan almost.
Oh, okay, yeah.
We always used to say Chicago because people don't know where Waukegan
sure,
is.
Sure, that's right. Well, I do, but I went to high school in Elmhurst, so that's about many, many years ago. So what's on your mind today, Luis?
Yeah. A friend of mine is Mason.
Uh-huh.
And we've been having conversations lately about it, and he, you know, during conversations, he was saying, you know, that's something that I may want to look into it.
You mean he wants you to become a Mason? Is that the kind of conversations that you're having, or he's just explaining it to you?
He's been explaining it to me, and he said that may be something I may want to apply for.
Uh-huh.
He's saying he likes it and all this stuff, and I'm a Christian, so I was wondering if that's something that I should biblically and morally be looking into, or is that something that I should avoid completely?
Yeah, well, the simple answer is no. And now I want to be careful I don't get out of my ken here, because I don't know a lot about Masons. That is, I can't cite you the chapter and verse and all this other stuff, but I do know there are a lot of people I know in kind of the business who do traffic in that information and have raised the serious concern about Masons, the system of thinking of the Masons being inconsistent with Christianity. And we just lost another caller. How is this happening? Luis, you probably listen to us on podcast now. my apologies, but we just we have this demon in our system that just keeps pushing the button. And so somebody's going to hear us going to have to fix this. But I'll finish answering the question for you. And I'm sorry, I'm embarrassed this keeps happening. But the system of belief of the Masons is a problem. Now, I'm not saying that there can't be people who are part of the club, certainly at the lower levels, the fraternal organization is what I mean, that can't be genuine Christians and followers of Christ. But my understanding is, and this is where you just have to go get some more.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you're back. Okay, good.
I'm back.
Did you dial? Oh, I'm really sorry about that. Okay, maybe two's a charm here. But a person could be part of the club, the fraternal organization, especially at the lower ends, I think, and not be aware of all of the stuff that's involved with being a Mason, and still have, in a sense, an orthodox understanding of the person of Jesus and what he did and God and his role, etc. However, my understanding is when you get higher levels and you start really kind of, you know, getting more granular or detailed about the beliefs of the Masons, it becomes stranger and stranger and stranger. And I think there Zondervan may have a little handbook along in its Zondervan Guide to the Cults on Masonic orders. I'm not sure, but I think do. They have a little analysis there and an outline of their beliefs and stuff like that. You might want to get on the web and try to look that up and see about books on Masonic orders. But that would be my suggestion. I mean, I could say confidently you should not be involved in this. You shouldn't be, but you have a friend that is, and it may be the case that you can talk to that friend in more detail. What is it that they believe about God precisely? What do they believe about Jesus precisely? It's a secret order, you know, so they have all these other secret things going on. You know, what is that all about? So there's nothing secret about Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so
now, is there, because my grandfather was part of the Knights of Columbus for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's a Roman Catholic group, though. That's different.
Exactly. And I've been invited to, me and my wife are both in the military, active duty.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been invited to be part of, like, the Navy Legion or different military groups. Are those in the same league as Masonry, or do you think, like, Masonry is worse?
I don't think. I have never heard things like Knights of Columbus characterize in the way that people characterize the Masons. Now, since Knights of Columbus are Roman Catholic, you know, whatever theological problems I have with Roman Catholicism, I probably have with Knights of Columbus. But that's all, you know, I can't say anything more about them because I know nothing about the content. I don't know that it's like a secret organization in the same way that the Masons are. The other order that you mentioned, I don't know about that either. So I just simply couldn't tell you. The real issue is, look, when you're talking to people that are inviting you to be involved in this, you can just ask them questions that go to the views that they hold. Masons claim to be a kind of a spiritual organization, so you want them to weigh in particular about their theological views about Jesus and God and the church and salvation and those kinds of things. When it comes to some of these other orders that you just mentioned, they may not have a spiritual element. The Navy has a group, apparently, and it may not have a spiritual element, and there may be nothing about the organization itself which would compromise your Christian convictions or your Christian conscience. And so it seems to me you'd be free then to engage there if you are interested in that sort of thing. But I just can't tell you for sure because I don't know about those other organizations.
Okay, so definitely something I need to be looking into and not just jump into it just because they say you can practice Christianity freely, because that's pretty much what my friend said, you know, that they believe you cannot join and be a Mason if you don't have God in your life or you don't believe in a religion.
Yeah.
They said you can practice Christianity freely, but then I was mostly concerned if I could really do it freely.
Yeah.
Inhibit it or, you know.
I wouldn't even consider it if I were you. I mean, I don't see any reason for you to do that. Basically, it's a fraternal brotherhood, and you build these strong relationships that are like forever relationships as you get into deeper levels. And it seems to me that these are the kind of relationships you want to build in the church with real followers of Christ, because the church is the fraternal brotherhood that will continue forever. You know, Masons won't. And there is a good chance that the Masonry can lead you adrift, I think. And that's why I'd stay away from it. All righty?
All right, thank you very much. Hopefully we'll be listening from Italy, because we're moving there in 1 month.
Oh, so, no kidding.
Yeah, we're getting stationed in Naples. So.
Well, buongiorno, you know.
All right.
All right, all the best to you. Okay, Luis, thanks a lot. Sir. See, that's the nice thing about podcasts. It doesn't matter where you're at, whether you're in Chicago or Little Italy or Real Italy, you can participate. All right, let's go to Hubbard, Texas. James, thanks for calling. Greg Kokel, how you doing?
Hey, Greg, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of my sons, you know, was close to the Lord, but now he's been watching the History Channel and all, and these documentaries on Jesus and all, and questions arise, and he just does not believe that Jesus rose from the dead.
Okay.
And, you know, one argument that we have is that the disciples gave their lives for what they believe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in religion, the Taliban, you know, give their lives.
Yes, right.
To fly planes into buildings.
Right, of course.
You know, this is a pivotal argument in Christianity
about
the resurrection of Jesus. If he didn't, then we're spinning our wheels.
Right.
What is your convicting heart argument that Jesus rose from?
Well, I'll give you what I think is the best way to approach this, and it will also entail an explanation or a response to what you just offered about them giving their lives, because the way you put it is actually a mischaracterization, at least in the spare way you put it. You might have been understanding correctly, but I'm going to offer an adjustment there that I think then you'll see the big difference between this and the Taliban. Because our argument isn't simply people died for it, so it must be true. I mean, this would be a foolish argument, actually, because people die for all kinds of things that aren't true. There is a more precise way of using that. Okay, so here's my argument. Here's how you can prove that Jesus rose from the dead. I'm going to give you the formal argument, and then we'll try to fill it in a little bit. Here's the formal argument. All you have to do is show that he was dead at point A in time, and then alive at point B in time. Now, this is the way John Warwick Montgomery has stated it, but it's really, that's all there is to it. Now, you got to fill it in a little bit, but you have to demonstrate he was dead, and then after that, he was alive. Now, how would you know he was dead? Well, because there was a record that said that he had died, you know, and people were testified to this or whatever. I will tell you, by the way, that it is not contested, really, among serious historians that Jesus of Nazareth died on a Roman cross. Even the people, I suspect, on the Discovery Channel, which, by the way, is not the best place to get your information about history. Remember, the Discovery Channel are the ones who did the Talpiot tomb about a year ago, right about now, and it was the tomb of Jesus, and it was a big embarrassment. You're not going to get even-handed academic analysis on the Discovery Channel, so just as a point of information. But even the people at the Discovery Channel, I think, and those who they interview, would be hard-pressed to argue that Jesus did not die on a Roman cross. All right? Are you with me there, James?
Yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure if we lost you. We've been losing callers here lately. Okay, so I know you're thinking, all right, that's not very convincing. Well, I'm just starting here. Let me give you the whole argument. I mean, fill in the argument. So everybody, even the Jesus Seminar people who believe that Jesus, and these are the kind of people who show up on things like Discovery Channel a lot, these people, they don't argue Jesus didn't die. They believe he died. All of these people believe he died. So we got Jesus dead on Good Friday, okay, executed on a Roman cross. Now we've got some other things. We've got an empty tomb. And we've got men who claimed to have seen Jesus. Now, I'll tell you, and Gary Habermas has done really good work here. There is almost nobody in the business, regardless of what their beliefs are, that don't believe that it was the case that the apostles believed they saw Jesus. So that Jesus died, almost virtually everybody agrees to, and that the disciples claimed to have seen him alive, this is not disputed. In fact, or that James was changed, or that Paul was changed from disbelief to belief. James was later martyred, and James's martyrdom is recorded by Josephus. So then the question is this: what accounts for their claim that they saw Jesus resurrected from the dead? You don't have too many options. One is they were hallucinating, all of them. Another one is that they were lying, all of them. Another one is they were, they saw the resurrected Jesus. I mean, pretty much there's only three options. Given this testimony that most people consider as legitimate, most historians, you're on solid ground historically to say that the disciples' lives were changed because they say they saw Jesus risen from the dead, and plus you have the problem of the empty tomb. Now what? What's the best answer? Groups don't have hallucinations like this. I mean, that's part of hallucinations happen inside people's heads. They don't happen outside in the middle of a room where everybody sees and hears the same thing. That's the first problem. That's the problem with hallucination. What about the lying disciples, which is probably the strongest response? Well, the disciples said they saw Jesus, but they were lying. And now here's where your observation that you made earlier, or the point that was made earlier, comes in. It would be very unusual for people to die for a lie when they knew it was a lie. This is the qualifying statement that was missing from your characterization, which is vital to the argument, which makes it different from the Taliban. The Taliban are, you know, strapping explosives to their chest and walking into crowded places and pushing the button. But they are doing it because they really are lying to everybody and themselves about Allah. They actually believe it's the case. People don't die for lies when they know it's a lie, not in mass. And for the disciples to claim that Jesus has risen from the dead put them at mortal risk. And in fact, many of them did die as a result of this, and certainly they got persecuted terribly as a result of this. Now, those who believed them might have died for a lie, not knowing it was a lie because they don't know. They're just believing somebody else. But the disciples themselves, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead and they say that he did, they would know that it wasn't true. Then why would they die for that? This turns out to be a very compelling argument, because you don't just have one person who might have been a little nutty. You have all of them that were involved with Jesus, who at first, according to the historical record, were running and hiding. Something happened 3 days later that transformed them. By the way, by their own testimony, when you look at the historical accounts, this is not a glowing report of the disciples' faith. What you see in the accounts is all of their lack of faith. This turns out to be evidence for the trustworthiness of those accounts. You have women in there giving information, and women if you're going to make a phony story, you don't put the salient details on the mouth of a woman because they weren't trusted. You don't characteristically. You don't then talk about your lousy faith and the fact that you disbelieved until, you know, and that you were all shaking in a corner, unless, of course, it actually happened that way. So the accounts do not have the earmarks of not forgery. What is the word I'm looking for? Like the fiction, like they're making all this stuff up. It doesn't. It rings true for some of the reasons that I'm talking about. This is why people take them seriously. And then you have to account for why did they believe this. And it seems like the answer that makes the most sense is they actually saw Jesus of Nazareth. And this happened, by the way, also to James and to Paul, who were not part of the original apostolic band. They were not believers. The first ones were. They weren't believers in the resurrection until Jesus appeared. But they were believers in Jesus. You know, and what, or they didn't know what to do after he died, but, you know, they were part of that band. But Paul and James were not. James was a half-brother of Jesus who ended up leading the Jerusalem church, and then Paul, of course, the greatest apostle. These had conversions after the resurrection, and the conversions were a result of the appearance of Jesus. Paul records this in 1 Corinthians 15 about James, and then the book of Acts. Well, and Paul in his own writings and in the book of Acts where Luke wrote, who is a companion of Paul, wrote about Paul's own conversion. So, you know, those need explanation. And I don't know what your son is hearing on the Discovery Channel that somehow goes against that. Sometimes the Discovery Channel will say, well, there's all kinds of myths of rising gods, you know, back then. Well, that certainly doesn't follow that even if there were such things, that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. You still have to answer the basic evidence for the resurrection. So let me recommend a book. I'm going to recommend a book, one big book, and then an author on smaller books for you to check this out on, okay?
Okay.
Gary Habermas, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S, Gary Habermas is the author of the bunch of smaller books. And he does a very good job of characterizing the resurrection here. He's the best source, I would say, to go to for smaller books. And he's got a handful of them, so I can't give you the titles. There's a couple of different ones.
Okay.
The other one is N.T. Wright. That would be W-R-I-G-H-T. And his book is called The Resurrection of the Son of God, I think it is. Does that sound right? The Resurrection? N.T. W-R-I-G-H-T. He's a scholar from the UK. And this is his magnum opus. It's a big, thick, like 900 pages. It covers everything about the resurrection.
Wow.
It is really, really powerful because it's so conclusive. If your son is genuinely interested in dealing with the facts and the arguments, then these are the kinds of books that he might read. You could read the N.T. Wright, maybe, because you might be more motivated to tackle that big book. I don't know where your son's at, but he certainly, I hope he's, if he's willing to listen to the Discovery Channel, then maybe he'd be willing to listen to it, to, you know, have some peer review here and have our guys kind of explain what he thought he saw that was compelling on the Discovery Channel. What do you think?
Yeah.
So Wright's work is the best one, though. I mean, that's the most thorough. All right, James?
Thank you so much for this answer. Okay.
You're welcome, brother. And listen, give me a call in a month or so and tell me how things are going.
Okay.
All right. All the best to you.
Okay, you too.
All right. That was a good call. 1-800-22... No, don't do that because we have... Okay. We got a break coming up, and we're going to it now. I'll be back in a moment on Stand to Reason.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's STR.org.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Greg Kochel and Stand to Reason back with you here in our final segment with the show that turns your mind on and makes your brain cells grow. I think I read that on the, or I watched that on Discovery Channel, that your brain cells can grow. That is, if they're properly stimulated, and we do that here. Every Sunday, 3 to 5, let's go back to the phones and talk with Jody. Jody, where you live at?
Hey, Greg, I live in Marina Del Rey.
Oh, okay, you're local. Good. What's on your mind?
And I feel my brain cells growing as we speak.
Good.
So thank you for that. My head's about to explode. Hey, I have a question relating to Messianic Judaism. I have a close friend who, she's not Jewish, but she's been attending a Messianic congregation for some time.
Yeah.
And she is thoroughly convinced and trying to persuade me that all believers in Jesus need to be following the law, the Torah. That Jesus did not come to fulfill that. Well, not that he did not come to fulfill it, but that, you know, you should be following those laws. And I talked to her until I was blue in the face, quoting scripture, saying, no, we are no longer bound by the law.
Oh, gosh, it's so...
to show us our sinfulness.
Right.
And it can't possibly be followed. And who can follow these? No
yes,
one can.
Uh-huh.
That's why Jesus came and so forth. What can I do to show her the truth?
Well,
and you can just tell me what the truth
okay,
is.
Okay, I'll tell you a couple of thoughts. First of all, I don't have high confidence that anything I'm going to tell you that you can tell her is going to make a difference in her thinking.
Sure.
But I was just talking with my brother yesterday about this. He lives in Florida, and he's been dealing with his brother-in-law for a long time about this extreme view. And he mentioned that even Hebrew scholars acknowledge that some 30, 40 or 50% of the commandments under the Old Covenant, the Mosaic Law, cannot be fulfilled outside of the land, for goodness sake.
Oh, really?
Just think, there are all kinds of commandments that are given in the law that can only be fulfilled in the land. Now, I don't know which ones these are, but it's an important observation.
Yeah.
And what do you do with these kinds of laws that are tied to functioning in the land in a certain way? Well, I don't know what they do to it, but it seems to make it pretty clear that you can't do this. Let me give you a couple of other thoughts. These are broad-based thoughts. And there's a website that you can go to. I'm going to patch it together here for you. I think it's called Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, Ministries. And I think the guy's name is like Fruchtenstein, like F-R-U-C-H... Oh, gosh. Well, Jody, we just lost you, Jody. You just went bye-bye. You can call us right back. And again, I'm sorry about this. And you're going to report this, right, to the people who we pay for this station to do this show? This is like, but since you're in Southern Cal, you can hear the rest of this. Fruchtenstein, F-R-U-C-H-T-E-N-S-T-I-S-T-E-I-N, something like that. I think it's Ariel Ministries, A-R-I-E-L. In any event, he talks, This is a Jewish guy who's a follower of Christ and who I think gets it right. And he's written on this on his website. You can go there and check this out. But here's the big deal. The law was never given to Gentiles. Are you back there, Jody?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. The law was never given to Gentiles. It was given to Jews. And it was given to Jews for a number of different purposes, but it's a Jewish covenant. Which covenant contract has been broken? Jeremiah 31:31. Jeremiah 31:31. And in Jeremiah, I'm trying to find it right now, Jeremiah, the new covenant is prophesied. So why is a new covenant necessary? Because the old one has been broken. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. That would be Mosaic covenant. My covenant which they broke. That is a broken, fractured covenant, according to Jeremiah, which necessitates a new covenant. And he goes on to explain what that is in chapter 31. And then Jesus at the Last Supper says, this is the body, my body, broken for you, the body for the new covenant. There it is. So we now live, all of the church, Jews and Gentiles alike, live under the new covenant, not under the old covenant. The old covenant is gone. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't things we can learn from it, but it does not apply to us in this way, and this is precisely what the problem was in the book of Galatians and the First Jerusalem Council, Acts 15, dealing with that issue.
So would it be fair to say then that anything that was part of the law, let's say the Ten Commandments, for example, you know, because they will argue back, well, so we're not supposed to follow the Ten Commandments?
No.
To which I would say, well, we have to follow the Ten Commandments because that harmonizes with everything that's in the New Testament, God's character, our obedience to God,
right,
what he
right.
wants from us. I mean, it's clear that we're supposed to do
right.
that.
Yeah, my answer to that is that, and here it's carefully nuanced, let me say it quickly because we're short on time. We are not obliged to follow the Ten Commandments as the Ten Commandments. We are not obliged to follow them because they are in the Mosaic Law, because there is no difference between the Ten Commandments and all the rest of them that follow them. And if we're obliged to keep the ten, we're obliged to keep them all, it seems to me. We are obliged to keep elements of the ten. I would say nine are repeated in the New Testament. The Sabbath is not. We are obliged to keep them because they were moral obligations before the Ten Commandments were ever given. They are included in the Mosaic Law because they are universal moral obligations. And that's why they're included there. But we are obliged to keep them as universal moral obligations, not simply in virtue of the fact that they're in the Mosaic Code.
Right. And what about the Sabbath, by the way, since we're all there?
The Sabbath is a Jewish command under the Old Covenant. We are not under the Old Covenant, so the Sabbath obligation no longer applies, nor does tithing, by the way. And that's why neither the Sabbath observance nor tithing is reinforced in the New Testament as a new covenant ideal.
Hmm. But would you say that those two things, even though they're not commandments, they are extremely good ideas?
There's wisdom in the Sabbath, but it doesn't have to be on Saturday, obviously, because no Christian observes it on Saturday except for Sabbatarians.
Right.
Nobody keeps the rank and file don't keep the Sabbath anyway the way it was commanded.
Right.
Even your friend, I suspect. And tithing is not taught. Rather, giving is taught, and there's a difference. Now, both you're still coming out of pocket for expenses, but the perspective is entirely different.
Okay, good. That helps an awful lot. I appreciate that, and I will go to Jeremiah 31 and 31, do a little work there, and see if I can help.
And try to find that website, Ariel Ministries. And there is a piece. We actually posted this on our – Melinda blogged on this, and we posted on it. There's a piece where he talks about the nature of the law, and he does a very, very good job, I think, of characterizing the relationship that we have now as New Testament, New Covenant Christians to the law that God gave. And his answer is, and I think this is sound, we are not obliged to that law as the Mosaic Law at all. That is a law given to a different people under a very specific circumstance, and he characterized it much like, you know, look, when you move from California to New York State, for example, you are no longer under the laws of California.
Right.
You are under the laws of New York State. Now, there might be some similarities, like, you know, you stop at stop signs and that kind of stuff, but you're not prosecuted under the old. You're prosecuted under the new. And so it is in virtue of the law of Christ, he says, that we are obliged to do certain things that are morally right. And we are still... Go ahead.
Am I accurate in saying that Jesus is the fulfillment of that law?
Yeah, well, he is in a number of fashions, actually. Though the law itself does not make the distinctions between the moral, ceremonial, and civil, I think there are real distinctions that can be made, though the law itself doesn't divide it up this way. Jesus fulfills this in a number of ways. He is the one who does keep the spirit of the law and the letter of the law perfectly. There was no sin that's found in him. So Jesus is the man who fulfills the law by proxy for us. So he fulfills it in that way. He also fulfills the law typologically because he is the Paschal Lamb who dies for the sins of the people. And he also fulfills the prophecy of the law. He also fulfills the, all aspects of it. So I think these are all things that are caught up in the idea of Jesus fulfilling the law. I think that's a more complex notion. And I wouldn't argue we don't have to keep the law because Jesus fulfilled it all for us, though it may be that he did. We don't have to keep the law because the law was never written for us. It was not written for Gentiles. It was written for Jews in a unique covenant with God. It was a law that was conditional. The conditions of which they didn't meet, it's broken. Therefore, a new covenant is given to guide the Jews and Gentiles, which are included under that covenant. So there you go, Jody. I thank you for your call.
You.
Yeah, check out that website. I found that was very, very enlightening. And we have it on our website somewhere, I think, at least in Melinda's blog, so you might check there. All right, friends, I'll see you next week. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Go out and give them heaven, all right? Bye-bye now.